Michael Wolf from our city tonight in LP. We're going to talk about large trials in our common diseases with, I think, particular reference to kidney cancer. And in the pre-meeting briefing, we understand that it's going to be a lot about the background of the disease with only a bit of stats. Is that right?
Yes, right. It's more to do with trial design.
More to do with trial design. So that leaves us an unusual scope for jumping in with our own ideas. So, excellent. Away you go.
Terrific. Good evening, everybody.
I'm a medical oncologist, which means I try to treat cancer with drugs. So, a very, very different field from the one you're in, apart from one of my colleagues, Deepak, who we work with. And James, we work with together as well. So I want to talk really about three things tonight, and please do jump in at any moment. I'm very used to being interrupted constantly. So I wanted to give a background to kidney cancer, because the title of an uncommon disease is, I think, one which just needs a little bit of exploring. How rare are these diseases? And then tell you about a particular interest of mine, which is to use adjuvant treatment. And I'm sure if there is jargon which is unclear, please just stop me. I want to talk about the current status of adjuvant trials in this particular disease, and then say how far we have got, and we are just on the point of deciding what to do next, so this is very timely. And I'm working with Max Palmer at the MRC Euston Road, and Patrick Royston, actually, I think, who some of the people in his audience will know, designed this study statistically. So we're very much looking forward to any ideas you might have to help make these studies as efficient and successful as possible, because ultimately the design of the study will partly determine whether any advances made are purely academic or can actually be applied, and that's extremely important. In fact, I would even say it's an ethical issue. So I think that the correct design of clinical studies, or the best design of clinical studies, is an extremely important issue which even today we don't really take enough care of. So I'm going to start with just a description of what kidney cancer is. And essentially, I'm talking about tumours which arise in the meat of the kidney. Other tumours arise in the lining of the kidney and the lining of the tube leading from the kidney to the bladder. So I'm not talking about these tumours here, which are what we call urothelial tumours. And they are an entirely different kind of tumour to the ones I am talking about, which are the renal cortical tumours, which arise in the meat of the kidney and behave in a very, very wide variety of ways.
So they're intrinsically invisible on this diagram?
They would grow in the meat of the kidney, and often they would actually be exophytic, so they grow out of the tumour, but they can be just lumps within the kidney, which we can still detect on ultrasound or on CT scan. But if you just looked at the kidney from the outside, you might not see it. That's true. And often these will start in an apparently benign looking cyst. Now cysts are quite common, about a third of us will have cysts in our kidney. It does not mean we are at risk of kidney cancer. But some cysts can develop, for reasons which we don't fully understand, into tumours. But you can also get a tumour arising de novo, nothing to do with the cyst. So you just have to admit that I'm rather ignorant, and so is everyone else, as far as I'm aware, on why these particularly are associated with cysts on occasion. And the more complicated a cyst with things growing inside it or a blood supply to it, the more suspicious we are. And so sometimes we would even remove a benign cyst because we're worried that it'll turn into a tumour. But usually we're dealing with something which is solid, and particularly something which enhances when you give contrast medium. So contrast medium is injected into the bloodstream, it's pumped around the body, and so we take CT pictures before and after the contrast medium has been pumped through, and those areas with a particularly rich blood supply light up. And in fact, kidney cancer is the best example in cancer medicine of a tumour which is dependent on a very, very rich blood supply, and I'll come back to why that is later. but it is the reason that our anti-blood vessel treatments have proved extremely successful, at least in oncological terms, extremely successful in kidney cancer and not so successful in other types of disease. Now, in fact, even as a medical oncologist, I'm afraid I have to admit the best treatment for cancer is surgery. And often, if you have a tumour which is growing out, particularly at one of the poles, the upper or lower pole of the tumour, of the kidney, you can, or a surgeon can, remove the tumour and just a very thin rim of normal kidney with a curative intent. And this is important, and I'll come back to the figures later on, but what we used to do, tumour there, take out the kidney, finished. Unfortunately, that has downsides as well, so that if you have somebody who maybe, say, I don't know, 40, and you take out a kidney, their risk, their lifetime risk of heart disease or stroke is much, much higher. And in fact, all of our kidney function will decline with age, and you need your kidneys, or at least you need one kidney. There is in fact no completely safe lower limit to renal function, so that the lower your renal function, the higher your risk of certain quite common diseases. So this is a real phenomenon, and it has altered the way we practice surgery. So we do the minimal surgery we can, which may be technically more advanced. So what I would call a nephrectomy is complete removal of the kidney. A partial nephrectomy is partial removal of the kidney, or removal of part of the kidney. And more recently, we've been doing laparoscopic surgery, which is sort of what most people call telescope surgery, which is a benefit, but there are pluses and minuses to it. The benefit is it causes much less morbidity for the patient. The downside is that to do laparoscopic surgery takes longer, and in particular, you need to clamp the blood vessels supplying and draining the kidney. Otherwise, you end up with a blood bath, which is not good. And the longer you do that, the more renal function you lose. So if the vessels are clamped for more than 20 minutes, you begin irreversibly to lose kidney function. So it's quite a quick operation. And there are people who can do this reliably, quickly, but they are very, very few and far between.
And doing it through a laparoscope must make it trickier to do it quickly.
It does. It does, exactly. And you also don't have access, you don't have the same access as if you've done an enormous incision and opened up the area. So that if you were trying to, if it was a very big tumour, you might not be able to do it. If it was involving other organs, you might not be able to do it. And sometimes, so for example, there might be competing risks. So, for example, if this tumour weren't at the top but in the middle, but the patient would still need their kidney function. So it is very, very difficult laparoscopically to remove that bit of kidney and then sew the bottom and the top together. So what you might do is actually do an open operation, and then you can do that. Just occasionally, we do what's called an auto transplant, or a bench transplant, which means that you remove the kidney, you operate it on it in a way that you would have to have complete access to the kidney, and then you put it back in. Well, I say we do. I don't do that. Our surgeons do that. Now, actually, our surgeons do all sorts of extremely macho things, and one of them is that the tumour, when it grows in the kidney, does not necessarily grow out of the kidney. It can grow into the kidney and commonly along the vein. So this is rather common, that it grows along the renal vein through the inferior vena cava and up through the diaphragm, which would be here, into the right side of the heart. And just occasionally, the most advanced one I think I've ever seen as a non-metastatic tumour is it's grown through a hole in the heart to the other side, and then down along the aorta. And that is still a curable situation, amazingly enough. So you can imagine that they're very, very frightening. It's extremely delicate surgery. But just an anecdote, really, to say that we do try to remove all the tumour if at all possible. However, as you will see later on, unfortunately that's not the whole story. And common sites of spread are lymph nodes along the major vessels, and then beyond that to bones and lung and lymph nodes, are the commonest sites of metastatic deposits. Now, even lymph nodes here, if you had two lymph nodes involved here, that, I'm afraid, almost has the same prognosis as somebody who's got distant metastases for reasons we don't fully understand. This is a very major prognostic factor.
Could you also get bladder cancer from the going down the urethra?
So the bladder cancers you would get, these tumours actually do not grow down the urethra.
Uh-huh.
They grow through the blood vessels. These tumours are urothelial tumours. Commonly it's a field change effect. So that if you have a urothelial tumour there, the treatment for that, if you try to cure it, would be to take out the kidney and the ureter all the way down.
But I was asking about the origin of it. Would it be distributed from the kidney cancer?
No. So kidney cancer, I cannot recall a case which has grown down the ureter.
Okay. So if you get one in that particular branch of the waterworks, it's not indicative of kidney cancer.
No, that's correct. Right. Although what you could get is this would be what we call a transitional cell carcinoma, just a descriptive term of what it looked like under the microscope. And if you have a transitional cell carcinoma, you're likely to have others, some of which may be in the pelvis of the kidney. So we can identify those. And they have a different appearance. You can't be definitive until you've actually looked at another microscope.
So that's what we're dealing with, really.
Now, in terms of numbers, I say a rare tumour, but it's approximately 3% of all adult cancers, so in the European Union that would be just over 60,000 new cases a year. And you can see that over a third of people actually die of the disease.
That's 63,000 in how many millions?
In Europe, per year, that's about 280-300 million.
Okay, so it's 1 per 50,000, is it? 1 per 5,000?
Something like that, yes.
60.
So it's about 8,000 per year in the United Kingdom. That's easier.
Too many noughts there.
You want the answer at the bottom there,
rate per 100,000?
Oh, right. Yeah, about 2 to 5.
And yes, it's good being female, probably because of smoking. Because if you think about what are the risk factors, the honest answer is that the only clear risk factor is smoking, which probably, according to the Oxford group, Richard Pito's team there, accounts for around about a quarter of the disease incidence. But he would say that might be an overestimate, but that's his central theory at the moment. Fatness, or so obesity does, and there are no other major risk factors that we know about. There is an association with high blood pressure and an association with diabetes, but we don't know whether that's chicken or egg. And you can see that the incidence has risen quite substantially over the last 30 odd years. Part of that is explained by our hugely increased use of imaging. So our use of ultrasound and CT scanning in particular has gone up many, many fold. So many of these will be what I would call incidental diagnoses. So diagnoses which are not made because you're expecting to find that, but because you find that when you're looking for something else. But the mortality has also risen in that period. Now, what I don't know, and I've asked the Oxford team, but they're not clear either, is what is the lag period in smoking? Because we are used, for example, in lung cancer, there has been a significant decrease in smoking, and with a lag period of something around 20 years, there's been a very significant decrease in the incidence of lung cancer. It's about halved, in fact, from what we had expected, had there been no change in the smoking incidence. And I cannot tell you what things are here. Although this tends to occur at a slightly younger age than smoking, so the chance of the lag is longer is low, I would say. So we can't really explain the increase in mortality, but you can see actually it's quite substantial. It's around 50% in 30 years.
So this is mortality from this cancer with that incidence of detected cancer.
Yes.
So it's about 50% mortality per detected case.
It is, actually, yes. Slightly less, but only slightly less, as you can see here. And there's no huge difference between the different countries in Europe. If anything, there's a preponderance in Northern Europe, but it's pretty slight.
Stabilised around 92, give or take rates.
Yes.
Are there any advances or
anything? I think that there have been not so much medical advances as surgical advances, so that we are much better at. For example, we were mentioning earlier tonight that you could take out somebody's kidney, render them dependent on dialysis, but get rid of the tumour. The problem there is you have competing risks and also a very significant reduction in the quality of life, which I think should not be forgotten. Now, we are much, much better at taking out some diseased part of the kidney and leaving somebody with sufficient kidney function to be off dialysis and have a quality of life. So, surgery is the only treatment commonly used for curative intent. And so I would suspect it's partly that. The other thing is that we have, as you will see in a couple of slides' time, we've introduced some drugs which do not cure but do prolong survival, or certainly prolong progression for survival. Which I'll talk about in a second. In terms of the survival, this is another way of looking at what you've just said. If you look at the 1, 5 and 10 year survival, you can see that there have been improvements over this time. Now, this is all-cause survival, not just from kidney cancer, so it's not going to be 100%. And there have been significant improvements, and I think they are predominantly due to stage shift and also improved chance of having a curative treatment. There's two things.
When you say due to stage shift, do you mean earlier diagnosis?
Yes, so that particularly with incidental tumours, incidentally discovered tumours are likely to be smaller and more easily resectable and removable. The other thing which has changed, to remove a tumour, it has to be resectable, technically removable, but the patient has to be operable, i.e. will survive the operation. And both of those things have changed quite a lot in the period that this diagram covers. And I would say those two things are more likely to have had an impact than anything else on a diagnosed tumour. But the other thing is that clearly if you have an early tumour, there will be a lag effect. So that tumour for tumour, you may appear to be doing better when in fact what we've done is make the same diagnosis but 20 years earlier, or 10, probably not quite 20, probably 5 or so years earlier than you are quite sort of done. Now, I will actually talk about these a bit later on, but I just want to emphasise that surgery is the best treatment, and these treatments are usually not curative. This one occasionally is. I'm not really going to talk about the immune system very much, but some people are very interested in it, and in fact we're all about to get a bit more interested in it, oncology, because we have a new range of drugs which are very sophisticated. I wasn't going to cover those today, but if anyone's interested, I'm very happy to discuss that. I just wanted to say a couple of words about our molecular understanding of the disease, which is definitely incomplete, but not completely absent. So the common kind of kidney cancer is called conventional or clear cell carcinoma of the kidney. And in fact, there is an abnormality in a gene called von Hippel-Lindau gene, which encodes a protein which helps you determine your response to low oxygen tension. So it particularly will change the behaviour of a cell, and it will recruit new blood vessels. And that's not the whole story. For example, if we have no good mouse model of the disease at the moment, if we ablate the VHL gene, you don't get kidney cancer. You do get cysts, but you don't get kidney cancer, because what's probably happening is you have unopposed activity of the of various cell signaling systems, and that tends to lead to cellular senescence, not to tumours. However, just down the road at the Sanger Centre, Andy Futrell and his team have recently discovered further genes called chromatin remodeling genes, and these may actually be the missing link, if you like, because if you have both an abnormality in the VHL gene and in the chromatin remodeling gene, your cells cannot become senescent. So you've destroyed that control mechanism.
That's our working theory at the moment, but that is really fairly hot off the press. It was only discovered earlier this year. And I think in view of the... Oh, I can cover this briefly. So VHL is this gene here. So it's a protein, part of a multi-protein complex, which targets proteins to add ubiquitin moieties onto them. And when you do that, it targets that protein for destruction. Okay, so this complex is a way of targeting that protein for destruction. Now, if the complex isn't working, as in the lower part of the diagram, then this will accumulate, and it's called hypoxia-inducible factor, and it will then shift to the nucleus and determine various aspects of cellular behaviour, such as the development of blood vessels and various environmental factors, and proliferation. And that is this little bit of diagram here. So I'm not going to cover this in tremendous detail unless people want me to, but the purpose of this slide is to let me show you where our new treatments work. So as I mentioned, this is responsible for the behavior of the cell, particularly in terms of releasing factors like vascular endothelial growth factor and platelet-derived growth factor, which help you develop a blood supply. And our new drugs work predominantly here to block that, to block that from happening, so the blood supply can be demolished very rapidly, particularly if it is abnormally regulated. Now, this is the tumour cell, this is a blood cell, and these are genetically normal cells, which are just abnormally regulated. So we're interfering with regulation, and the cells are able to respond to that regulation. And that's probably the secret of its success. We also have other new drugs which work more directly on the tumour cell. And I don't intend to cover those any further today unless somebody's particularly interested. This is undoubtedly a gross oversimplification. And for example, one important oversimplification is these same receptors are also present on the tumour cell. So the tumour is releasing factors which stimulate themselves in a sort of autocrine way. And that's probably one of the reasons that they get so...
And is that factor, when it hits the blood cell, likely to make the blood cell cancerous?
No. So this is an endothelial cell, so this is a blood vessel cell, mm-hmm. and it remains genetically normal.
All right.
And will remain able to respond to normal regulatory signals. One interesting thing, which I won't mention again, is that usually in cancer medicine, if you try a particular treatment and it works for a bit and then it stops working, if you use the same treatment or a similar treatment, you won't get any further benefit. You'll just produce further toxicities for the patient. That is not the case with these drugs. So that we can, this would be our standard first line drug, so we might use that for a year. It's not easy on the patient, but most patients can tolerate it. And then it might fail, and our standard second-line drug would be this one here. And then you're rather desperate for something to do. Perhaps there's a trial going with one of these other agents or another agent of this type, and you're very likely to get a further response. So you can go back to the mechanism of action which previously failed. We don't know why that is. I personally suspect, and there are some data to support, that it is because these are genetically normal and able to respond to regulatory signals.
And those are the patients who progressed or not patients who came off due to toxicity, right?
Predominantly, yes. Although there would be some patients, for example, these as a group have hypertension as a side effect, for example. And if your blood pressure shot up and was uncontrollably high,
yeah.
you probably wouldn't go to another drug of the same class. And you might go to this sort of class here. But predominantly, you are correct that you would do it because the tumour was no longer under control.
Okay. So So sorry, so this majority of patients discontinue those for progression.
Yes.
How many patients typically will discontinue due to toxicity?
So if you are treating people in the if you're treating people in the metastatic disease settings and they have advanced disease, you're trying to control it, around about 10% will come off treatment, be unable to tolerate treatment. In the adjuvant setting, it's at least double and possibly triple that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And in first line, then that's a pretty re-challenge with similar...
So after an adjuvant trial?
Sure.
Typically, yes. Well, it actually would depend... In my book, if I were advising somebody and they were on a trial of adjuvant treatment and they developed further disease on that treatment and they were on a decent dose of treatment, I probably would think how much benefit might they have had from that adjuvant treatment already.
Right.
Because if it's within a month of starting treatment, they're going to be resistant to that treatment.
Yeah.
If it's after 2 years of treatment, then there is a chance that actually intensifying that treatment would make a difference.
I better get on to some design issues. I just wanted to give you an idea. The purpose of this slide is to show you how very long it takes to do a thing. When I started, we were using only treatments to activate the immune system in the 80s. And I will show you a slide of that. But the interesting thing about these is that for most people, they're very toxic, and most people do not benefit at all. But about 3 to 5% of patients benefit enormously and get a complete response to treatment, i.e. complete response to their disease, and it doesn't come back. But it doesn't come back in about half of people who obtain a complete response. So wouldn't it be wonderful if we could identify who those people are? But we can't yet. And in fact, the same is true of this very, very aggressive treatment here, which I won't mention again. And in America, you can get that treatment. In fact, we have two centres in the UK where I sometimes refer patients who I think might benefit from that treatment. But you have to be young, very fit, very keen to have a small chance of a very big benefit. And then these treatments here really derive from this scientific finding here. And you can see that it has taken about a decade for the first trial really to show benefit from our understanding that VHL was abnormal in this condition. So it's a long time. It's a long time. And in fact, the first licenses are only here in the mid-2000s. And the first use in the United Kingdom in the National Health Service is about 5 years after that. We've only really had them for the last 3 years. So there are enormous delays, and I think any patient, anybody would want quicker progress. This is the sort of order of benefit that we had before, and it's not totally negligible, but you just need to bear in mind that this is not necessarily the average patient. So these are fairly grim figures. They are quite old as well. They're over a decade old, and the study had taken 5 years or 6 years to do. But you can see that the median survival is under a year. This is for patients with metastatic disease, and this is essentially a placebo. A tiny, tiny proportion of patients appear to get some benefit. That's probably just consistent with the natural history of the disease. And this is an immunotherapy drug, which you can see produces, on average, or median benefit is 2.5 months or something around that. So although it's statistically significant for us, it's clinically of borderline significance, particularly when you consider there are significant toxicity in treatment. So that's where we were.
Just quickly on that one, what are the two curves?
Oh, I'm sorry. The lower curve is how those patients, the proportion of patients alive if they've received progesterone.
Okay.
The upper curve is the proportion of patients alive if they've received interferon. And the difference between the two, this is an overall survival benefit. So many of the things I'm going to show you are actually, I think, in clinical terms, less impressive in that they're probably not overall survival benefits.
progression-free survival benefits. And there's a technical definition of what progression what constitutes progression, and the absence of such progression means that you are surviving progression-free for X months.
Thank you.
Now, as far as I'm aware, every single prediction made about anti-blood vessel treatment or anti-angiogenic treatment has been incorrect. The first was that it was going to be very well tolerated, and I'll show you that it isn't necessarily. Second is that it would need to be used continuously, and the only data we have is that that is not the case. And the third is that it would be very easy to combine with other treatments, and that certainly isn't the case. So it is interesting that we have had to reconsider all of our ways of estimating whether a treatment is effective or not. And this is a statistical issue because we need surrogate markers of benefit. And I'm going to come back to this in the adjuvant setting because we are completely lacking surrogate markers of benefit except for very long-term markers. And any ideas you have on that score would be very gratefully received, because I would say that's the single biggest factor preventing us making more rapid progress. Now, what this graph shows is that if on this axis is the percentage growth or shrinkage of disease measured as...
It says reduction.
Yes, but it can be, so above here, that's probably not a good title. It's change rather than...
Okay.
It should be change rather than reduction. So this up here is growth.
Right.
Down here is reduction.
Okay.
And each middle bar is a patient. And that's for patients on placebo. This is for patients on one of those anti-blood vessel drugs called sorafenib. And this is the one we're using in our trial. So that's why I put this slide up as opposed to any other. Now, our usual surrogate marker for activity of an anti-cancer treatment is response, meaning shrinkage of disease, so that the sum of diameters of the measured lesions shrinks by 30% or more. So you would need a bar to be in this region here, so here a tiny proportion of patients, and here around 6 or 7% of patients. And we probably would have rejected this treatment on that score. But in fact, what you can see is that the whole curve is shifted downwards, and that whereas here 20% or so of patients are having either no growth or some shrinkage, here around 3/4 of patients are having that. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. You're saying the whole curve has shifted downwards, which isn't quite exact, because it's also vertically shrunk on the right. But there is a sense in which
the maximum benefit received by a patient on placebo exceeds the maximum benefit received by a patient on sorafenib.
Yes, and I just think that probably what I should have said is that this may well be somebody who has a single metastasis and then somebody removes it, which counts as responsive.
Yeah, because that's just practically a single example, that right-hand tail, isn't it?
Practically a single example, yes. Yes. And so, I mean, in total there are 574 patients in this assessment, or it was actually a larger study, it was the first slide, I thought. So why is that? Because we would normally have rejected this treatment as ineffective. And the answer, we think, is this. Although we are seeing, as in these two top panels, some degree of shrinkage, and that's what we would normally be measuring, what we more commonly see with these drugs is this sort of thing. So this is somebody's liver. And this is a large metastasis in the liver. And what you can see is that there is a sort of white rim to it. And that is tumour which has an active blood supply. So this particular picture is taken at the time where the blood is going through the tumour, and you can see that it has quite a rich blood supply here, and then it also has a sort of central core which does not have a rich blood supply, and that's quite common in tumours, particularly in kidney tumours. And after 6 weeks of treatment, although there is some shrinkage, it's not a very significant shrinkage, and we would call that stable disease technically. I think you can see that the white rim is more ragged and thinner,
and this central swollen.
Is swollen. Yes, and we interpret that as necrosis or death of the central part of the tumour, and so we're quite used to seeing that. But the measurements have not changed, and there are lots of examples of this, and that might be one reason why we have underestimated the activity of these treatments. So this again is an indicator of what sort of surrogate marker we need.
Would a tumour eventually shrink?
Not necessarily, no. No. And in fact, you are right, James, that there is a relationship between shrinkage and duration of benefit. So if you get a very good shrinkage, it is likely to last longer than somebody who just has stable disease. But you can have people who have stable disease for years on end with never having any shrinkage. Equally, I'm afraid you can get people who have excellent shrinkage and come straight back.
But if that picture on the right, so the darker area basically taking over the whole of the tumour, what does that mean for the life of the tumour and the life of the patient?
It means that the disease, something very simple actually, it means the disease is not growing.
Would it be an interpretation of a question that is this dark material which you described as sort of semi-necrotic,
yes,
as neutral tissue, so to speak, non-menacing tissue,
it's there. Probably not viable tissue, yes.
Yeah.
It's probably dead. So if you biopsied it, it would just be dead tissue.
Uh-huh. But not necrotic.
Yeah, necrotic.
And necrotic tissue, but I see.
But what I couldn't say is that this little bit here is not viable either. So these might be marginally viable, and if you stop the treatment, put it this way, if you stop the treatment, it'll go back to that quite quickly.
Right.
And there are difficulties about this. So, for example, we have data from laboratory animals which may or may not reflect the disease, that if you give a very gentle anti-blood vessel treatment, you can maintain this picture for longer than if you give a really intense one. And there are various theories why that might be, but more is not necessarily better. I think that is clear.
So by the time the patient stops, the metastasis, their overall survival is going to be pretty short. So, I mean, when you see this type of tumour, how does that then affect overall survival? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a significant or a noticeable thing between the two?
It's very interesting because the slide I showed you with the trial with the interferon versus progesterone, the primary endpoint there was overall survival. In all the subsequent studies, bar one, the primary endpoint is progression-free survival. And then when somebody has progressed, they're able to cross over to the other active treatment. So that severely compromises. I've got another slide just to discuss this a little bit further. But that does severely compromise your ability to say this will enable the patient to live longer. Because they will get more treatments.
You did late time, though. Did you say that's true?
This is second line, this particular one.
Yeah.
Later lines of treatment, studies are difficult to do in later lines of treatment, partly because the number of patients would be fit enough to want third, fourth, fifth line treatment is quite small. And also because if you survive to third, fourth, fifth line treatment, it probably means your disease is more indolent than on average. So that those data may not really be applicable to the ordinary person in the clinic. You would need to be fit, you would need to have that sort of indolent disease. So it is very difficult to study that. And this has not been a problem outside the United Kingdom. So most health economies will accept progression-free survival as a benefit. NICE tends not to, at least except in breast cancer, where it has protected. So it is a difficulty for us, but I will show you a slide. I might perhaps try and find a slide.
No, that's a, there we are. Okay. So
there are analyses which I personally think are quite specious. I mean, it'd be very interesting in your view, but this is something which persuaded Nice. So this is from a different study to establish our standard treatment, sumitinib, where they have... So the data show that there was a doubling of progression-free survival from about 6 to about 12 months. So if you were on interferon, you had about 6 months of progression-free survival, and if you were on sunitinib, you had about 12 months of progression-free survival. And NICE didn't think that was enough benefit. So a further analysis was done, and they considered... So NICE was happy with considering overall survival in patients who did not receive any treatment after their study allocated treatment. And you can see that it was quite a high proportion of the patients, in fact, in this study. But if you just received interferon, your median overall survival was around 14 months. Compare that to the earlier study where the same group of patients had a median overall survival of 8 months. So there's been quite a change in that period, and we're not entirely sure why that is, and it's probably due to patient selection. And will partly be due to better standard of care, but I suspect predominantly the first. And if you only got sunitinib, you survived on average 28 months. And I would say that this does in fact now reflect how we use the treatments in clinical practice. We're much better at using them. We don't just stop for some problem. We give patients breaks. So that our clinic, for example, when I came here 5 years ago, our clinic was usually 10 people in each clinic. Now it's 50, and we're going to have to another clinic. So I think this is a real benefit, but I would say this is specious because if you think about it, if you get interferon and you don't get sunitinib, even though it's available and there's no other way of getting it and you know it's active, you are either ill or have some other reason for not wanting further treatment. On the other hand, if you get sunitinib and don't get interferon, you're likely to be treated in an academic centre or to be doing particularly well where you will have other options. And that's why I think it's a specious thing, but it's satisfied nice.
First of all, one small point, that's actually not a percentage scale on the left.
No, it isn't actually.
Yes. Now, this means that after 28 months, you've got 50% who have actually survived on the sunitinib, and something like 35% who have survived on the interferon. And both curves are showing signs of levelling out at that point.
Yes.
I don't know what would happen later on down the line. I mean, it eventually must go to zero. But,
it does. Yes.
But it looks as if it's going to go quite slowly.
Although the number of patients at risk at this point is very low.
Well, you're on 40% of 162, say.
No, you're not.
No, not necessarily, because every patient will have been on trial that long to have a significant...
Oh, I see, right.
...earlier, and as they're sentencing...
Okay, so, say when this levels out at, say, 35%, that is not 35% of the original number.
No, it's just... So down here, there, I think, I haven't actually got it on here, but sometimes they put that number at risk here, but it's around sort of 10 to 30. So there would be a lot of excursion here.
Right.
So I haven't got the confidence intervals at each point here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's not what?
It's not yellow, it's blue.
Oh, yes, yes. It's spotted. I can tell you the progression-free survival ones. I cannot tell you the overall survival ones. But I think the overall survival... I can tell you what the significant... I can tell you what the p-value was. Because it was just under 0.05.
Yeah.
Even analysing it in this slightly questionable way. We would normally one thing is analysed by attention to treatment, and this isn't.
You'd be surprised that NICE took this as good evidence, because it's not a randomised comparison, is it? You're not randomising who doesn't receive treatment after the trial, and only marginally.
Well, I'm afraid this is where my political antennae sort of trump my scientific ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is a poor analysis. But, you know, I'm in the position that I know the treatment is active. Patients benefit within days of getting it. And I would probably do almost anything to enable access to that for patients. And so this was a means of doing that. And I wasn't going to at this point. I just wanted them to be able to provide the drug. I suspect for political reasons they wanted to provide the drug too, because there was not much other news at the time. It made a huge splash. And so we just needed to get that.
I always thought NICE were really conservative.
No, they're not. And I think that's my problem with them, that the rules change according to how much pressure they're under.
Tim, that's interesting. You're saying this is a rubbish analysis because it's biased, it's not intentional. It's marginally significant, and yet you're convinced as a clinician that sunitinib is effective. Why are the statistics so out of kilter with your personal perspective?
I'm not saying that they are saying the wrong thing. I think this is a fair reflection of the truth. I don't think it's reliable. I don't think you could draw that conclusion from this analysis. That's what
0.05 to me means absolutely nothing.
Right.
In my context, and I just want to walk away from that. But it clearly
yes.
To you, and yet you are convinced that the drug is effective. I'm fascinated that the statistics can't draw out your clinical perspective.
Well, I'm
but
saying...
this is not the only evidence.
No, I was going to add that. So there are a number of studies showing doubling of progression-free survival. If you look at... with this particular drug, there's significant debulking of disease, shrinkage of disease as well. I know it is an active treatment. What I'm not, even now, I would not be confident to say what is the overall survival benefit. I could not say it's X months, because I actually don't know that, because I think that we are better at looking after patients irrespective of the drugs. We do not do things which are toxic and pointless, which will shorten patients' lives. So there's another study I haven't shown, which I think shows that a particular treatment called temsirolimus is active. And the reason it appears to be active is that, in fact, control treatments are so toxic and so ill-advised in that group that they probably shouldn't be applied. So, I mean, my question really back to you is what degree of certainty I need to have, because I'm in the position that I think if I have a strong belief for whatever reason that something is in a patient's interest, I would normally try to obtain that for the patient. I would normally need to try to persuade current private care trust to obtain that. So in this case, I would say if your clinics are filling up with people you would expect to have been dead long ago and have a good quality of life, then probably what you are doing is effective, although I cannot prove it in statistical terms. I just think it's extremely unlikely that there is there must have been some explanation for it, and I can't figure it out. But what I would say is that if I just looked at this analysis, I personally would not find that convincing, because you could punch holes in it.
No.
So I don't need to go through this. This is really just to say that having started off with the black figures in this country up till, well, certainly in this country, it was just with this one here, up till about 2007, we now have this huge number of treatments. And that raises other issues about how should we investigate this, and we don't really want to be in the pocket of the pharmaceutical companies, and we want to make some real benefits.
It's all right, I just might get it.
Right, I can always come back to that if people want. I think there's quite a lot more to say, so I don't want to bore you with this too much, but I just want to say that these benefits, doubling of progression-free survival, and some, as yet in my view, unquantified overall survival benefit, are obtained at considerable financial cost, but more importantly, cost to the patient in terms of toxicity. So what it's quite interesting actually how you measure something, because we have measured the toxicities of these using something called common toxicity criteria, CTC, which were designed for use developing chemotherapies. Chemotherapies, by and large, are very unpleasant, but intermittent and finite. So you might give 6 cycles, 1 every 3 weeks of a particularly unpleasant treatment, you have a very unpleasant period, then it's finished. These treatments are given basically day in, day out, for as long as they are controlling the disease. So something like stomatitis wasn't even reported in the early studies because it was all grade 1, grade 2, which we would say is a trivial problem. But grade 2 stomatitis is a very sore mouth. And if you have that every day of your life, it assumes much greater importance than if you have it for a few days. Much greater. It's obvious. But it took us, I'm afraid, some time to realize that. So I'm not going to go through these, but that was one point I wanted to make. And the other was that we learned that actually just forming our own judgment without asking the patient was even more misleading than usual. And so this does not look very impressive. So, all right, there's a bit of redness there, no ulcers, grade 1, bit of skin thickening there, still not ulcerated. And this patient was working with paper and still able to work. And the only problem is that this patient is not able to walk, because although it looks trivial, the CTC criteria understate the impact on the patient. So I won't talk about that more unless somebody wants me to, but it's really... where I wanted just to, that is the background, I'm sorry it's gone on rather, but I now want to get on to risk, ask your opinion on various things. So I'm particularly interested in adjuvant treatment. It's a very common oncological attempt to find what works to control advanced disease and then try to bring that forward so that you're not just controlling disease, you're reducing the risk of it coming back. So this is to increase the cure rate. And I think this concept of adjuvant treatment is very important. There are a couple of other concepts. What sort of patient would you want to treat? You don't want to treat somebody, ideally, who's already cured, because you're just giving them toxicity and there can't be any benefit if they're already cured. You don't want to treat somebody who's going to be resistant to treatment, because however much treatment you give them, it's going to come back and there's no indication that you're doing them any benefit. So you do want somebody to have a disease which is going to come back and will be sensitive to treatment. But the problem is we cannot identify those patients, and that's why adjuvant studies by and large need to be very large. And I think one of the major challenges, which I want to come back to later, is how do we most efficiently design studies that can use our existing technologies and adapt to novel technologies to be able to treat those patients who truly get benefit. How can we do that as quickly as possible? And we are still at a very basic level. Simple isn't necessarily bad, though. So we want to work out the risk of an individual patient having a further problem. Okay? What we do not want to do is to treat somebody who's going to do fine anyway. So we assign a simple score. So this is something from the Mayo Clinic in North America. By Bradley Leibovich, and he, this is based on the outcome from about 2,000 patients treated at the Mayo Clinic, and having analysed the data, they came up with this model where you assign a number of points for a number of risk factors. So the stage of the primary tumour, whether it's a small localised tumour, or at the other end of the scale, whether it's growing into the vein and perhaps into neighbouring organs, you get a different number of points. Whether there are any lymph nodes involved, and I would say that this probably is something which understates the risk, and that's the model we're working with. The absolute size of the tumour, how aggressive the tumour nuclei look under the microscope, whether or not there is any necrosis. Now you might think, oh great, it's necrotic, that's good news. In fact, it appears to be an adverse factor, and we don't really understand why, but those data are certainly consistent with our clinical feeling. And if you add up all those points, you can plot somebody's risk in terms of their percentage chance of being, free of metastases, at any number of years after the resection of their tumour. And so we would say that these people are low risk. I think we probably all agree on that. But these people are clearly at enormous risk of metastasis, and unfortunately metastasis does appear to be a very good surrogate marker for eventual death from disease, with a lag period of around 2 years nowadays. Yeah. Those are the survival figures if you have metastatic disease.
To go back to the previous slide.
Yes.
Sorry. There is, in the background, there's some basis on which 2 points on the primary tumour scale is somehow equivalent to 2 points on regional lymph nodes, or is it just arbitrary?
So this is the result of a multivariate analysis.
Right.
And a portion of risk.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Well, sort of, yes, sort of. But...
I suppose it's a shift from 0 to 2 in the primary tumour, and that relates to a shift from 0 to 2 in regional lymph nodes.
In terms of...
Right, I see what you mean.
It would be the same.
So that's meant to be the same. It's meant to confer the same degree of risk.
Yeah.
That's my understanding, anyway.
And this is also allowing for interactions as well. So you could have greater primary tumour with or without involvement of regional lymph nodes.
Yes, you could. So this is a result of multivariate analysis.
Yeah.
But this doesn't include interactions because you just don't have the scores.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I see. So that in fact, if you, for example, had a PT1B tumour and lymph node and presence of lymph
node, it would be worse.
It might be even worse.
The sum might be greater or less than the smart parts.
Mm.
When I played around with this, it's very hard to show interactions like that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it becomes impossible in practice to do anything.
And would you need an enormous series to be able to...
Well, of course, the bigger the better, I guess.
Yeah.
But I don't know how useful interactions are in practice, because they may be present, but they're probably small as compared to the additive effects, not the clinical.
Well, it would depend on the mechanisms, because the presence of it, say,
I suspect it's a clinical impression here.
Yeah.
You would know that a particular combination is much worse than one or the other. I mean, if you did know that, if you'd noticed that, you'd look for it in the whole, I suspect.
I mean, I would say clinically we don't know that. I mean, I'm not aware of any particular pattern of disease which feels grim.
But it's also multiple comparison problem. You can look for interactions and find them.
Yeah, but the point of the question was that in the next diagram you're actually adding up scores from all sources.
Yes.
And there is some supposition that their effects on survival are comparable.
Yes.
Per point.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And in its defence, I would say this is extremely easy to use.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because before we did the trial, interestingly, trials often change practice. So before we started this trial, in this trial I'm about to talk about in this country, we didn't actually assess risk for patients at all. So if patients ask, they'd usually be told they'll probably be all right by the surgeon. Yeah, that's their usual answer. Because if you don't have any mechanism for giving adjuvant treatment, there's no need for us to have a mechanism to give adjuvant treatment, because there's nothing effective.
So, we sort of covered that. Now, I think just in terms of just general risk, we have called 0.12 low risk, 3.45 intermediate risk, and more than 6 or more high risk. And why is that important? Because this is where the politics of clinical trials meet the science. Simplicity is the way to complete a trial successfully. You must remove all complexity unless it's absolutely essential. And I think it was, I think it might have been Stephen Hawking in one of his books. He was told, although it's probably A Brief History of Time, he was told that for every mathematical equation he put in, he would halve his sales. And I think there's a sort of something similar in trials. For everything you ask the trial team to do, you will lose patients who might want to enter the trial. These are the adjuvant trials which have been done and have reported, and I think, rather than going through them in detail, I'll make two brief comments. One is, most of them are very small, so what sort of effect are we looking for? In general terms in oncology, you're looking for an adjuvant benefit of about 5% absolute survival benefit at 5 years or thereabouts. That's the sort of thing we look for with breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and lung cancer. And that's what Patrick, he actually powered it to be a slightly more effective intervention than that, because we were looking at metastasis-free survival rather than movable survival, if you wanted to make it a little bit harder to pass that mark. So that's one question, one point. We occasionally give neoadjuvant therapy. It's certainly not standard. I do it very, very rarely, and it is for patients who are whose disease is marginally unresectable. So that if you've had some shrinkage, if the surgeon had been able to do it. That's probably once or twice a year. Am I running out of time?
No, you okay, so far.
Okay, all right.
Is it because the diagnosis is, as I said at the very beginning, is very difficult to detect until such time grows quite big?
It can be difficult to detect. It usually is a silent tumour. It can grow very, very slowly, which gives you quite a large window to detect it in. There has been a reduction in the proportion of patients who present with locally advanced or metastatic disease, probably simply because the chance of somebody getting a CT or an ultrasound during their life is now much, much higher than it used to be even 10 years ago. Much higher. And I'm not saying, because if you ask a surgeon will say the size of a tumour doesn't determine whether I can remove it. What determines whether I can remove it is the fitness of the patient and their ability to withstand surgery and its aftermath. And whether or not the tumour has spread beyond what a surgeon can remove. And
if it has infiltrated into neighbouring tissues.
Even then, so you can remove part of the liver, you can remove a bit of gut, you can remove a bit of muscle. And you can remove quite a lot of blood vessel. So it is quite unusual. And in fact, the sort of
tumour index will be confounded by the amount of
it is so unusual to give it. I'm not quite sure. If you are asking, do we ever give it?
Yeah.
We do rarely.
And is that
it would be the same mistakes. Outside a clinical trial, we would hardly ever use it. And the sort of person you might use it for would be somebody whose tumour is engulfing, say, something that you really couldn't do without, but you were able to. And you might try, because occasionally you get a very dramatic shrinkage of disease, and then you could actually remove it. And in fact, I have a couple of patients who the surgeons have done really amazing jobs on them after I have given a cycle or two cycles. So it does work, but actually, bizarrely, it's not a common thing to do.
Results
there. I'm sorry.
Ops.
I'm sorry, observation. So that would just be the standard of care.
Mm.
So our standard of care in the absence of adjuvant therapy is to have the same CT scans for the same time intervals, but without treatment.
And the effects are all rather small, aren't they?
The effects are all rather small. Although we are in the sort of ballpark that we would say, if that had in fact been proven, since that is quite a good study to talk about, because there are two things there. If that were true, we would give that treatment. Unfortunately, it's a German intergroup study, and when you're trying to do something new, I think it's really important in clinical trials to be very conservative in the way you present it. they made a terrible mistake, and I think it's a terrible pity. They presented it not by intention to treat. So, for example, they managed to forget about the 174 people lost at randomization because they couldn't make the vaccine. So they presented it by those people who had been successfully vaccinated versus observation. And I remember it being presented, and I remember a very nice but pretty aggressive American oncologist just literally ripping him apart. He didn't have a leg to stand on. It was incorrectly presented, and it was very misleading. So they did actually go back, and this is by intention to treat. And I would say that actually that is something we would normally accept. But by the time that they'd done that, it had been determined that they really needed to repeat the study, because if they presented it in this way, it does rather raise a query as to how correctly they conducted the study. And by this time, the company making the vaccine had gone bust. And you know, you've put 553 patients into a study that will not make a difference. And I think that's really bad.
So the fact is, yeah, that's rather than DFS.
That is correct. So that, yes, the reason that we used progression-free survival there was simply because of the way they did the scans to detect progression. But we would still want to have disease, but it is actually a different... You could say that we should have actually put disease-free survival there, and it's a technical definition, but it's trying to measure this essentially the same thing. I don't think that's the main issue. But, you know, even a study with 553 patients, and that's one-to-one randomized, that's a very, very small number of patients to detect this sort of benefit.
So, small studies.
So, looking back to what I was saying earlier about the novel treatments, I think this unfortunately is true. There's clearly poor prognosis for the selected groups. We have no proven adjuvant treatment, that's definite. We have established the efficacy of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, mainly anti-angiogenic or anti-blood vessel tyrosine kinase inhibitors in advanced renal cell cancer. These are mostly tablets. They're relatively well tolerated. I think there should be a relatively in there. And we thought they were very suitable for use in this sort of setting. So these are the studies that were done, we have been doing. This one is a big American study, and you can see that originally it was going to be 1,300 patients, and it has been increased to 1,900 patients. This is a one-to-one-to-one randomization between sorafenib, placebo, and sunitinib, and the comparisons will be between sorafenib and placebo, or at least the statistically valid comparisons will be between sorafenib and placebo and sunitinib and placebo. Of course, as clinicians, we'll be very interested in the comparison between sorafenib and sunitinib. It's not actually powered for that. So we shall see. The reason they needed to increase the study size was the proportion of patients dropping out of study, which comes back to your earlier point. And it's about, this study, it's nearly
40%. Oh, right. And but the event rate, is that the aspect that it's just the number of dropouts?
So that's another interesting thing. Yeah. The event rate is lower than you would predict if you believed the the Likert score. And the reason for that, I think, is that these patients are properly staged, meaning we do a proper CT scan, a careful look at it, and if we see something small which we don't know what it is, we say the patient, and we can either prove it is benign by repeating a CT scan or doing some other biopsy or something, and proving it's benign, or we say the patient is not eligible for study. In the real world, we wouldn't do that.
All the patients have either been diagnosed by the same method or are somehow categorized according to the method of diagnosis.
They all have renal cell carcinoma.
Yes.
Removed. All of these patients have had their tumor removed.
Okay.
And they may have been cured. But
right.
These patients in the top two studies are at high or intermediate risk according to the scoring system I said. Actually, they're using slightly different scoring systems, but no, not a major difference.
So this is all. This is all post-surgery.
These are all post-surgery.
Right. Okay.
And you've got the pin up there, which is that's relevant because it's where the hazard ratio, not the number of events. So what sort of number of events are they counting that pin up or
So the well, I can tell you about this one here. The interim analysis is at 200 events.
Right. So you're maybe going for 400 events or by now the ratio 0.75. Mm. But then that's going to be a tiny proportion of the data at that time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, so the view, so you know how early we were looking at those curves and they're very mature, so you can see it unleveling out. Mm. Is that likely to happen again just because so few events relative to the number of patients?
There'll
be a huge number of sensors, right?
There's going to be a huge number of sensors.
Mm.
Yes. Sensor patients, that's undoubtedly true. And I think it's one of the problems about these sorts of studies. I think they're quite difficult studies to do. And the biggest single problem that we can't speed up is that we have no surrogate marker in the adjuvant setting for whether the treatment's working, apart from the event rate. And that the event rate in most of these studies is disease-free survival or metastasis-free survival, too. And that is quite a late marker of the lab. So you may have had hundreds of patients on this treatment. I think the other thing just to say is that this study has run into problems. They all run into problems because of dropout rate. These are more difficult to tolerate in the advanced disease setting. And this one here ran into a problem because these patients are so high risk that by the time you decided that this patient, yes, we can offer this patient an entry to study, a significant proportion of them had already progressed. Which raises, begs a question, which is, so if these patients by definition are very high risk, so just because you can see it on a CT scan now doesn't mean it wasn't present before. So why, what's so special about being able to see it on a CT scan? And I think that's another question which we should perhaps ask. So this is the study that Patrick and I are mainly designing, and it's designed to answer two clinical questions. The first is that of patients with high or intermediate risk of resected renal cell carcinoma, does at least 1 year of sorafenib reduce the risk of recovery? That's the primary question. And the secondary question is, if the answer to that question is yes, it does, then is it better to give 3 years of treatment rather than 1 year of treatment? And obviously have much more power to decide to answer the primary question. Even with this number of patients looking for an absolute benefit in terms of disease-free survival of 7%, and we only have 80% power to defend that. So it's, that's the sort of sums that we had to compromise on. And this study is now about two-thirds of the way through, so we've recruited around 1,150 patients to it. And I want to come on to the future trials in a second, but from the studies so far, we know that we can definitely recruit patients to this sort of study, so we can identify the patients, we can interest the patients, a proportion of patients, which is a roughly two-thirds of patients when it's discussed with them, will elect to go into the study if they're eligible for it, and about a third went for a variety of reasons. Unfortunately, this is definitely true. The toxicity profile is worse in the adjuvant setting than in metastatic disease. Those are the figures for the source study, the study I've just talked about. Interestingly, I was told that you cannot keep a patient on treatment for 3 years. That's not the case. Mm-hmm. The difficult period is actually the first 12 weeks. If you get the right dose and control symptoms and side effects well in that period, very few patients actually come off treatment after that time. But 80% of patients who come off treatment will actually come off treatment in the first 12 weeks. And I'm a chief investigator, and I'm sort of asking people to focus on the tolerable dose, not the highest dose, with a modest benefit, I would say.
Just related to that, is this trial intended to be double-blind?
Yes, it is double-blinded, but how? No, I don't think it is.
I don't think the double-blind is really valid, because I thought it was going to be valid because in the other study I showed where the, well, I said that one curve seemed to have just gone south a little bit, that was using the same drug. And in that study we did ask people, because that was double blind as well, do you think your patient has been on placebo or on sorafenib? And we all said what we thought, and in fact it was no better than chance. So we thought, terrific, this is a valid thing, and when you're looking at disease-free or progression-free survival, I think it's really very important, if you can have a placebo or a double-blind, to have that, because otherwise you can very easily corrupt progression-free survival, which you can't do with overall survival.
What's the route of administration of the drug?
Oral.
It is oral. And is it calculated at an meter square or
no? It's a flat dose. It's got extremely variable first-pass metabolism, and also it's got extremely variable uptake. So there's inter- and intra-patient variability. Right? And that is why, in a way, it's reasonable to try and get somebody on the highest tolerable dose rather than specified. We use the same dose in a big rugby player and a small player.
Is there any indication that intensity of patient reaction, intolerance to the drug, is related to the cancer?
That's a very interesting, I think there are two points to make. The first is that, ironically, I think, from treating lots of patients with these drugs, I think the fitter you are, particularly the younger you are, the worse you tolerate the treatment. Because these drugs work by interfering with a damped biological system. And my working theory, for which I have absolutely no proof, is that fit patients are able to mount a greater response to that intervention than an older, sicker person is. And also, one of the things that happens, you're blocking vascular endothelial growth factor working on its receptor. If you do that, then the level of vascular endothelial growth factor in your body goes up very, very significantly. And that appears to correlate, for example, with rash and with high blood pressure. So it might do in that respect.
So the breast cancer combined with leukemia is associated with increased survival.
Yeah.
So do you think the case would be similar here with the toxicity for the younger patient? Would they?
No, I think that the biological effect may correlate with that. As I was saying earlier, more is not necessarily better here. There is some worry that too strong and anti-angiogenic and therefore hypoxic stimulation to a tumour or blockade of a tumour may actually select a clone which is relatively aggressive. A couple of other questions that I just really wanted to raise in this group, because we're wrestling with them. We've done quite well with the translational components, and of course we're particularly interested in selecting or knowing which patients are going to tolerate treatment well. Actually about to do a genome-wide association study for the first 1,000 patients to look at that, where we have probably enough data to reach a conclusion, at least on our common candidates. And also we have found that people like to take part in these. What we have great difficulty doing is collecting fresh frozen tissue. So we can very easily collect blood and genomic DNA, fresh genomic DNA. We have great difficulty collecting fresh tumour DNA, which with our current technology is important, although in a few years we're able to do more and more with formalin-fixed tissue. So this may actually disappear as an issue, which is quite an issue at the moment. The next thing I think, which is we were sort of mentioning before, is what is the definition of adjuvant? Our technologies are changing quite quickly. So, for example, one project I'm doing with somebody called Nitzan Rosenfeld, who's a very clever molecular biologist, is because in clear cell carcinoma we can identify the main molecular mutation in about 95% of patients, we can look specifically for that mutation or hypermethylation in circulating tumour DNA.
And that perhaps could be a molecular marker of disease, as we have molecular markers of disease, particularly in hematological malignancies. So that might do two things. It might identify a risk group, and it might be something that we could follow, and if the signal were getting worse rather than better, i.e. more, indicating more disease, we might, perhaps, if we knew that that was in, that correlated with a poor outcome, we would know that our treatment was failing, and we wouldn't torture a person any further, perhaps onto something else instead. So I think that will be very important. Our scanners are also getting dramatically better, so the proportion of people who are excluded from studies because we've identified something so small that there's absolutely no way we could biopsy it or do any other test is now rising quite quickly. And we're going to have to do something about that, otherwise we won't be able to offer patients trials.
The event rate is lower than we thought, and these trials take a very long time. So another thing that I think, this is the last slide before I start to tell you what our next design I hope will be. The point of this slide is that we'll, after all these studies have been done, we'll have a great idea of the natural history of the disease, which was not the object of the exercise, clearly. We are looking for relatively small effects, and the only study to have more than 1,000 patients in a particular receiving a particular intervention is the MRC study. And all these other studies looking for very similar effects, effect sizes, are really very small. And I think the chance of here, unless this is an enormous effect, we're not going to have a waste of time, really.
And I think we have to cope with that somehow.
So we don't know how to do that. We'd be very grateful for any advice. These are, in clinical terms, what we think are the key questions. The optimal use of existing agents. We have lots of agents which we know are active. Going back to our earlier discussion, we strongly suspect are active. Should we use them in the near adjuvant setting, i.e. before surgery? Would that be a good thing to do? I think the intensity and duration is important. I haven't put in a slide about anti-blood vessel treatment in other contexts, but there is a study which has been reported as negative. Everyone that received Wisdom is it's completely negative, looking at an antibody called bevacizumab or Avastin added to chemotherapy in the adjuvant treatment of colorectal cancer. Right? So you've had a colorectal cancer removed, high risk, or whatever, however it's defined, and you get chemotherapy either with or without this anti-blood vessel treatment. And actually, at 5 years, there's no difference between the arms. But it's a one-year treatment. And if you look at 15 months, the hazard ratio there is 0.6 for relapse. So which indicates to me that there may be some activity, and it may be related to duration of treatment. Now, I think, as I was saying earlier, one of the main problems is patients coming out of treatment because they can't tolerate the treatment. So if we do we need to use our maximum dose? I don't think there's any evidence that that's the case. And do we perhaps need to use very long durations of treatment? Should we perhaps compare very long durations of treatment to very short or no treatment? And I think therefore the intensity and duration questions are terribly important. Whether we would be able to persuade the clinical trials committees that that's the case, I have many more doubts. Because I think I feel that we as investigators think this is the key question. But it's different to persuading a grant committee that that's the case. You're all familiar with those sorts of problems. There are new agents coming through. Are they genuinely better than the agents we have at the moment? We can discuss that. I think the trials design and meta-analysis will be very interesting in people's views. I'll come on to that in a second. We have included some basic health economics because we wanted to include enough data to be able to calculate an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio so that if we show the benefit, we would be able to say it's nice and it costs this much. But actually, we're probably moving to value-based commissioning. so that if there were a benefit, then there would be a negotiation about how much that was worth for the health service.
And clearly we want to be able to target our treatment better. So what we would probably end up doing is a multi-arm, multi-stage design
This has already been used in a study sort of like Stampede. I don't know if people have heard of Stampede. It's a trial in prostate cancer where there are multiple arms. There's a control arm which can change depending on new data, and there are a number of arms in it which undergo a series of analyses, which I'll come back to in a second. But the reason that they were in, so this slide is actually more to do with prostate cancer than to do with a renal cancer, but I'm trying to see whether we could employ the same sort of strategy in renal cancer. There are lots of different agents, or at least ways of using those agents. There's no clear reason at the moment to choose any particular treatment modality, and we would like to be able to have some basis on which to make a choice. Not necessarily very definite, but some indication that we're not, at least a futility analysis would be useful. And we would like to be able to assess multiple, I'm not sure we'd say all, but multiple interesting agents. So we wanted, in the Stampede design, to start by testing many agents and to focus on the more active agents using lack of benefit analyses later on. So this would be the traditional, so that should be all the way around really, but this is the traditional approach where we do a number of phase two studies, show some evidence of benefit, and then this would usually be in the advanced disease setting, and then you might do advanced disease studies and subsequently adjuvant studies to look for benefit in the adjuvant setting. Now, I think this would just take too long in renal cancer. We really would like to accelerate matters. So this is something that Max Palmer and others at the MRC have designed. And it is to include both a series of investigations to select those not definite, which are not definitely active or the best, but look as if they might be. So we're trying to enrich the chance of us selecting the right, ultimately the right ones to investigate. So we have a phase two period where we would have multiple multiple arms which we would expect to prune, so that once we get to the later stages of this study, an arm such as T1, which had got to the later stage of this study, had looked very promising all along here. And you might choose to do these analyses at different points. And there are a number of potential advantages. It is said to use fewer patients, so that we would hope to expose fewer patients to pointless treatments. That's ultimately what we're trying to do. And more patients to ultimately active treatments. It is quicker in that we won't waste patients' time and our time and money investigating in phase three anything except those options which have looked good in phase two. It allows us to adapt to any new results and focus on the most promising arms. So for example, to use the adjuvant renal cancer setting, if one of the studies that I've talked about reports to say that yes, actually you should use sorafenib for 3 years, we could replace the observation arm, which would currently still have to be the standard arm, with a new standard arm. And I think that's moderately likely to happen. And if it is more efficient, it would ultimately reduce costs
and improve value.
So what would we look for? I think a reasonable surrogate for ultimate benefit in phase two would be disease-free survival. Clearly, we would collect other data as well, but it would be this which would be a reasonable surrogate for ultimate benefit for the patient. But in the later stages, we would really want to look for overall survival, particularly if we've not got a placebo, which we probably couldn't. You couldn't have a placebo in a multi-arm study. Mm-hmm.
Giving dozens of pointless of placebo treatments.
So we would need to set predetermined hurdles which an arm which was going to progress would need to clear. We might want to drop arms, clearly for safety reasons, which we haven't really addressed except in passing today,
a lack of activity clearly, and as I say, in the light of new data, so you might want to drop an observation arm, or even what you think might be an active arm if it's being investigated in another study and it comes back as possibly uninteresting. You might add arms, and we'd hope to add arms, to investigate new treatment and to reflect any new standard. And I think there's another practical thing which I probably wouldn't put up here for the benefit of clinical trials committees, but it's a practical consideration, particularly where we don't routinely give any adjuvant treatment, which is if you stop doing this trial, your ability to do such a trial goes back to zero. So it is much better to have a rolling program than a program which stops and starts, particularly if that stop is for more than a few months, because things just evaporate.
So that's my last slide, which is just to say that I'm trying to convince you that kidney cancer treatment has evolved quite rapidly in the past 8 years, and sometimes by hook and by crook, I would say, rather than the usual robust way that we would like to do things, but that's been the only way we could really get everything that we needed, we felt, for the patients. Unfortunately, the targeted therapies do not cure advanced cancer. But they may be of benefit in the adjuvant setting, and I think we want to investigate the treatments that we know are active in the advanced setting in the adjuvant setting, and there's clearly a requirement for efficient trial methodologies, and that's where I think I really like this group's help. Thank you very much.
Oh, fascinating discussion.
I was just wanting to, do this group of drugs seem to benefit patients with a particular molecular characteristics like the HO, because you mentioned something like 75%?
Yes, so we don't know the answer to that question, but it is a very good question, and all the studies will be trying to answer that. So Patrick Royston is actually one of his specialties is meta-analysis. So when we were designing this study, the source study, we went to our opposite numbers with the other really big study, which is an ECOG study, so that we will be able to pool not only the clinical data but also the translational data, which we hope would enable us to answer your questions. So what the approach we have taken, because this study from start to finish will take about 12 years. So the technology 12 years before you're going to analyze it is not going to be the state of technology when you come to analyze it, except you may do some interim analyses. So the most important thing is to collect the samples correctly, not to design the exact analyses. And that's what we've done. But we would want to be able to answer not only VHL mutant or wild type or methylated or unmethylated, but the other genes that have now been discovered which we did not have any inkling about, we will be able to do all of that, or at least we'll have the samples to be able to do all of that.
That's one thing, more from the point of view of trying to stratify patients according to...
Yes. We can't do that at the moment. And I think even if we do find something from these studies to do precisely that, it would be, I think we probably would not, we would want to validate what we had found before we actually stratified patients, because we might stratify them incorrectly. Because we can't stratify for very many factors even in a large study. So we would choose the stratification factors very carefully, and we would probably not want to use unvalidated stratification factors. We have no option here. So the Leibovitz scoring system which we're using is unvalidated, but there is no validated scoring system. So we had to do something like that, where we would prefer not to have to do that. So in this, it's a bit of a ratchet, so that we will try to validate the Leibovitz scoring system or modify it in this study, and then we would be able to have a more accurate idea, perhaps to answer the interaction questions if there are.
You answered the question yourself, actually, because you said you grouped in on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I can't explain why, but in interaction terms, most unlikely to shift you between those three groups. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes, because they're pretty wide margins anyway. Yeah.
Does your trial aim to take all patients?
So in this trial, it is powered for clear cell carcinoma of intermediate or high risk, but we do actually allow patients with other renal cell carcinomas, of which about a quarter will have a different kind of renal cell carcinoma, a malignant renal cell carcinoma, which we would still call renal cell carcinoma, but it is actually a different disease. They have different molecular bases. They have some things in common and many things which are different. However, if you look at the concordance rate between pathologists, so if you ask pathologist one and pathologist two, what is this and what subtype of kidney cancer is it, the concordance rate is about 60%, or at least was at the beginning of this study. It's actually higher now. So I felt that the right thing to do was to admit as many cases as wanted, as many people as wanted to enter the study, as, so long as they had a kidney cancer, but to power it for clear cell.
When you talk about dropping odds for live events, how exactly are you going to identify that live efficacy? Presumably it's from some kind of conditional power measure to show a difference.
So in a non-statistical way, I would say that if an arm at an interim analysis had a very small chance of beating observation or the other arms being dropped.
Okay. And then I guess the natural question that follows from that is, so you dropped it because of lack of efficacy and disease-free survival at some interim analysis, which we're fairly sure you weren't being narrowed to show a strong difference with anyway.
Right.
But even if that were true, you're then asserting that disease-free survival in some way is indicative of long-term survival without it actually being a validated surrogate endpoint. So I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do. I think that I'm not alone in looking at designs like that in the past too, but how are you going to deal with the situation, or do you envision a situation where then the owners of said drugs then really get quite upset about the fact they've been dropped over a non-validated surrogate endpoint?
We're definitely never want to be in that pocket, and I think that that's one of the major benefits of academic trials.
Right.
So that in the agreement setting up the trial, the data belongs to, in this case, to the MRC, and the decisions belong to the MRC, or the province of the MRC. And even it sometimes works in the opposite direction, because these trials, the budgets are hugely different from academic and also companies wanting trials. So this trial costs about £12 million plus free drug, which may sound like a fair amount of money, but a clinical trial would cost roughly 10 times that amount. We're done commercially. And so I don't think we should undersell ourselves, which I think is a mistake we made here. We could do a better trial with a bit more money. And for them it's still a bargain. Occasionally, in my experience actually, dropping an arm is never difficult to persuade a company that they're wasting their money. It's much more difficult to persuade them to continue to do something which they think will fail.
Yeah, because to an extent you actually need to determine the limits at which failure occurs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And we have no very good way of doing that, which I think you were sort of alluding to, that we're using disease-free survival, which we think is a good surrogate. We've approved it. We're going to have to do that in phase two, where we're looking for a signal of lack of efficacy or a lack of signal. Because if you have, say you have eight arms, four of them are showing an encouraging signal and four of them aren't, I think it is a reasonable thing to drop the least effective.
So, for instance, if you get back to that point, which is, so, as you put it well, non-statistical terms, the chance you'll show a difference in the future. So there's two ways of actually looking at that. There's a chance you'll show a difference given the current trend, or there's a chance you'll still show a difference given your anticipated trend with your observations today.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea being your observations today, hypothesized value as true, or given what you've observed so far, is your true value. And I mean, do you see what I mean?
I do see what you mean.
I think that's fairly complex, pretty quick.
Yes.
I suppose we feel that we have to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make a decision on the best available data. And we think this is the best available data. And we do agree that it's not perfect.
Right.
And we will make mistakes. But in general terms, we hope that we will make fewer mistakes and waste fewer people's time if we do this to select those articles that look the most promising. But we will make mistakes.
Can I ask you another slight worry I have about this mega trial that's been so low for whatever? Because it's always easier to criticise than to come up with the idea in the first place, so I do that caveat. But I'm just worried about how long the trial is going to take and the basic premise of comparing like with like. And if in the first years of the study you're beginning to drop some arms and then including the other ones in,
Well, the source trial will take
right.
12 years from opening to analysis.
You showed us right at the outset the change in prognosis in relatively short time. Are the sorts of patients you're going to be recruiting in 5 years' time going to be similar to those that you're recruiting today?
Right.
And of course techniques of all sorts of things will have evolved as well.
This group of patients in the source study is much more homogenous than the group of patients who would have been in those bar charts that I started the talk with, because these patients all have high or intermediate risk tumour, have had that resected according to the same criteria. Whereas in those original figures, that's all comers, and there would be a very large, the biggest change will have been the proportion of patients with very early tumours we would not have detected for another 5, 6, 7 years, unless we had happened to do an ultrasound or a CT scan for, I don't know, diarrhea or something, and that's quite common. So we see patients every week who have had this diagnosis out of the blue, which is quite difficult for them. They had no reason to suspect that there was anything like this. So I think that accounts for the majority of what you see in that big change in life expectancy, because that is not stage matched. And if you did stage match it, then you'd see a much, much more modest change, much more modest. You would see quite a big change over the last few years in terms of survival. In fact, Macmillan has just produced data which looked terribly encouraging until you realise that this is still not cure. We can now keep our average patients, we would estimate, live for around 3 years on average, whereas previously it would have been around a year. So that's improvement, but it's not more than that. And I think that I don't think that's going to be such a problem, unless there's some massive new therapy which looks very good. But I would say that argues in favour of this design. So, for example, say one of these new immunotherapies that we're hoping to start putting in trials this year, which really do look very exciting for a particular group of patients, say that comes up trumps and we really want to use that in the adjuvant setting. We can do that with this study, which you could not do with a non-adaptive design.
Sure, surely you can put a baseline adjustment in for the year of diagnosis, which but then you couldn't go back to primary analysis. It would always be exploratory, or you couldn't specify all that identifier, could you?
Well, not explicitly, no. I mean, you could fit a linear trend, which would be very simple-minded, but it would not come
to some of it.
You've got a placebo,
we do.
When do you see that dropping? If you're dropping. dropping out?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, because we don't break the blind for dropping out. We break the blind for progression, because I need to know what treatment a patient has had to be able to advise them what treatment to have next.
So what will happen to the, will the placebo continue all the way through the different stages?
So a placebo patient would be followed up according to exactly the same protocol, so
yeah.
They would have a treatment, whether it's it would be placebo in their case, for 3 years and then stop treatment.
Yeah.
And they would still have the same CT scans, and
which
we basically follow people up for 7 years in total, for 5 years in total.
But will you still be
randomising patients to placebo?
Yes. Are you talking about it? Well, the ethics are perfectly okay, because there is no demonstrated benefit from any adjuvant treatment, so it's perfectly reasonable to give somebody a placebo.
Initially, but you're perceiving the benefits as you do your interim analysis.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you're talking about the new. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
in the new study design. Apologies. If the placebo arm, so say that's the standard, which would be the standard arm to start with, if that looked as if it were less effective than another arm, I think there is a case for dropping it. However, I would be very reluctant to do that, because the time I would like to drop the placebo arm is when there is another new treatment, which has been shown to be of adjuvant benefit. And then you would replace the placebo standard arm with the new standard arm. But to do a study without a standard arm will mean that NICE will just say meaningless data.
But this thing,
I'm just thinking of the evolution of treatment.
Yeah.
So, but there's no point. I think it's entirely defensible to retain placebo as one of, or observation as one of the arms, until there is something which is shown to be better, and then you drop it.
But if you do that, the placebo base has been running for some time.
Mm.
If you then switch to something else,
mm-hmm.
its baseline is presumably less well defined than the placebo arm.
Yes.
So you have a fuzzier base from then on.
Yes.
And that there must be some disadvantage in that.
There is a disadvantage, which is that meant you can't draw such robust conclusions until the trial has been running for longer.
Yes.
However,
so in fact you your next stage is going to have to be longer than your first stage, or potentially longer.
Potentially, because we would hope that the new treatment would reduce the event rate.
Mm.
Mm. But that is the only ethical thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be unethical to have a placebo or observation arm when you knew that there was something that this group of patients could have that would improve their outcome.
Mm.
That would be unethical. James.
If you're willing to stop the trial, once you found an arm which is clearly better than placebo, you're saying that the trial changed significantly.
Mm.
In that case, why don't you allow efficacy stopping as well, and have a more formal efficacy boundary for stopping if it's going to stop the trial?
I suppose because we're very cynical and we think it's much, much less likely to happen. But if that did happen, if there were an arm, there are always, for a study of this sort, there would be an independent data monitoring committee, which is free to do it, perform any analyses it wants, in fact. In fact, one of the problems with independent data monitoring committees is that they do analyses, not always in the presence of a complete understanding of the issues around the study.
Mm.
But they can do it. And if they decided that arm C is clearly effective, they would stop the study.
So if you're worried about the data,
or at least in this rolling arm, in this little rolling study, they would stop every arm except C, and say, if you want to continue the study, you've now got to think of, you'd interrupt the study, and you're going to have to redesign the rest of the study. But in practical terms, that's probably going to end the study.
So if you're worried about the data monitoring committee kind of going rogue and doing all of these extra analyses, then wouldn't it be better to by having a formal stopping down
to provide parameters within it which to operate? Yes, it probably is, and we're not very good at that.
Mm.
But even when you write those down, you write them down in the absence of any data at all.
Yes.
And then the data monitoring committee have the boundaries that they see the data and they're going to react to that. So
yeah, it's a difficult job.
They
I do sit on these things too, and they are tricky.
Yes.
In your slide, you showed different arms, and I presume you just meant different drugs or chemotherapies. But what about the frequency of administration? So, you know, like in the US, they're giving 4-week cycles, in the UK, 6, or combinations of sequential therapies.
I didn't necessarily mean different drugs.
Right.
So for example, I think the duration and intensity of our existing treatments is a very realistic. I would personally be interested in looking at one of the next range of drugs which are more potent, more specific, better tolerated, because there'll be a much lower fallout dropout rate, I would guess. I mean, they're very well tolerated drugs, so patients experience hypertension, which to them is nothing except having pain, having to go on an antihypertensive agent, but they feel normal. They don't get the rash, they don't get the fatigue, they don't get that sore mouth. They're just better drugs. And that their efficacy does not appear to be better than it. I would say the efficacy has plateaued with this sort of approach. But in terms of, is this a study still worth asking? To me, it is a question worth asking. Whether clinical trials grants committee will see it that way, I don't know. That's a worry. But no, I don't just mean different drugs.
Well, I think it's clear that this could go on forever, like your projected trials. I think this has been perhaps the most open-ended discussion meeting we've had within memory. So, and it's certainly got us all thinking, and I hope our responses have been some use to you.
Thank you.
And in conclusion, therefore, thank you very much indeed. Now, next business is that we all have to get out of here. A few of us know the way, I certainly do. If anybody wishes to have a toilet before leaving,